With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And this is the first of several podcasts that I'm going to do on the state of Great Britain on the eve of the Second World War. So the first of these podcasts is really going to be a kind of an overview of Britain's economy and society and during the mid-1930s. And we're going to start from the year 1936, when Edward the Eighth abdicated and George the Sixth took the throne to be crowned the following year in 1937. And at the moment we're going to be looking at Britain's War by Daniel Todman, which is a truly amazing social history, British social history, of the Second World War. And he begins by contextualising Britain's experience during the Second World War with the pre-war decades, and makes the clear point that Britain's experience of the Great Depression had transformed British society and politics in a way that would have been in some ways unrecognisable to the decade of the 1920s. Now, for those of you who've heard me talk before about Adam Tooze's amazing book, The Deluge, The Deluge begins in the year 1916, because 1916 is the year when the American economy eclipsed that of Great Britain. And Great Britain, as a result of the war, became a debtor nation instead of being the world's creditor. It borrowed instead of lending. And it was the desperate need for finance and material that saw America surge ahead, and also the disruption to Britain's economy, Britain's world trade and markets led to America seizing opportunities during the war. Now, the thing about that year of 1916 is that it is the beginnings of what would later be acknowledged under Harold Macmillan as relative economic decline. Not absolute. The British economy doesn't collapse and the British economy doesn't shrink to being next to nothing. It's still, throughout the rest of the 20th century, one of the top five by the 1960s and top eight by the 1970s global economies. So gradually we see a decline in position from the dominant economy of the world that Britain was for much of the 19th century. But by 1936, the British economy is still, even with the Great Depression to contend with, still a kind of a powerful and wealthy state. So Daniel Todman writes, When George VI came to the throne, the UK was still distinguished internationally by its industrial and trading wealth. Very few Britons worked the land. Instead, they lived around huge cities, most of them in seven great conurbations: London, Glasgow, Manchester, Leeds, Birmingham, Liverpool and Sheffield, where they worked in factories, offices and shops. In the rest of the world, only Belgium was as heavily urbanised as the UK. When it came to sucking in food and raw material imports from abroad and churning out manufactured goods for exports, Britain still led the world. So there is an interesting comparison with the United States in 1936, that Britain is more urbanised, more industrialised per head of population than America. And it's really the experience of the Second World War that once again sends America this huge economic and industrial transformation to become the leading technological, military, scientific and manufacturing power in the world. The British had long since grown in terms of population far greater than could be sustained by British agriculture alone, and this was certainly the case a century beforehand, and the British were also highly reliant on the globalisation of their food supply, wheat from Canada and food from across the British Empire, which was a strength of the British economy, but also during wartime a significant weakness. And whilst the kind of epicentre of global finance was shifting from London to New York, the British insuring houses and banks still led the way. As Daniel Todman writes, the UK also remained central to the machinery of international commerce, with British banks and insurance houses holding colossal overseas assets and the British registered merchant fleet dwarfing any other. He adds, the period between the wars saw a rapid expansion of new forms of manufacturing driven on by growing domestic consumption, including motor cars, household electrical goods, man-made cloth and processed foods. Britain was beginning to change and transition away from heavy to light industry. The British economy had been based on four main staples: steel, coal, cotton and shipbuilding for much of the 19th century. But not only was Britain beginning to lose its comparative advantage in these industries in the early 20th century due to a lack of poor management and underinvestment, but also these industries, particularly coal mining and shipbuilding, were beginning to develop around the world in countries which were able to produce these kinds of commodities far, far cheaper. There is a very interesting story in Empire of Cotton by Sven Beckett about the development of a cotton industry in China during the 1930s under the nationalist leadership of Chiang Kai-shek, and how the Chinese had ambitions to return cotton spinning back to China, where much of it originated centuries beforehand, and use that as one of their staple industries to dominate the economy of Southeast Asia, thus muscling the British out almost. So there's a kind of a clue as to how heavy industries were eventually kind of weaponised against the British economy, and instead of remaining static, the British economy began to transition into lighter manufacturing, as it says here, electrical goods and motor cars and that kind of thing. Why? Because there were new demographics within Britain, the new middle classes that had the kind of disposable income that would make these industries viable. These industries, these became good export industries, and also as living standards gradually improved, and things like houses were gradually electrified, and there was a house building house building sort of initiative, a wave of house building projects in the second half of the 1930s, the development of new towns in Britain and garden cities, and these featured mainly electrified houses, and the electrified houses are great places to put electrical consumer goods in, and so that kind of infrastructure building created new markets for new kinds of products. The popular engagement with science and technology and engineering was significant during the 1930s, and the scientific expert became a far more central figure in British life. The profusion of books such as the Victor Galanx's Left Book Club or Alan Lane's Penguin series, which explained scientific or philosophical ideas in simple, accessible terms for a population that had a far greater appetite than ever before for hearing these sorts of things, is an example of public engagement with science, technology and other kind of related philosophical areas. The problem, of course, with the development of light industries and the decline of heavy industries is the decline of heavy industrial areas. Now, the Great Depression that begins in 1929 and ends in Britain roughly around 1934-1935 it's a regionalised Great Depression. It's not a Great Depression that affects the country uniformly. It's regionalised in areas where there are pockets of heavy industry, particularly the staples of coal, iron, steel, cotton and shipbuilding. And it is these areas that struggle, and there is, other than the Special Areas Act, very, very little that's actually done for them. Hence you have this kind of contrasting period during the Great Depression of pockets of deep deprivation, and also in some areas the experience of rising living standards. New industries, such as the kind of the chemical industries, such as ICI, for example, were, and also engineering industries, would be pivotal to Britain's war effort. The fact that the British economy was globalised, i.e. it had huge export markets, but also was an importer of food and other raw materials, meant that Britain was intimately connected to the world economy. And some historians have argued that the British Empire itself was one of the kind of the key drivers of this thing we call globalisation, that has different kind of phases. And there is some argument to suggest that is indeed valid. This global nature of the British economy, the development of science and industry, and changes in the work that British people did, meant that most British people experienced a sense of things being modernised or more modern, or they experienced waves of modernity throughout the...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
1930s. And in the field of technology, field of communications, this is particularly pronounced. At the end of the First World War, and for the two decades that followed, motor vehicles became more and more a feature of everyday life. In Julia Gardner's book, The 1930s, An Intimate Portrait, she writes about the various kind of problems of road transportation and road traffic, and the fact that a liberalisation of road traffic led to horrific numbers of road deaths, and it was only sort of the Minister Leslie Haubalisha who introduced new driving regulations, which suddenly stopped the carnage on the roads. Horse-drawn vehicles had all but disappeared from the roads by the 1930s, and car ownership was mainly the preserve of the better off. And from 1930 onwards, passenger miles travelled every year in cars and buses and motorbikes grew, and they eclipsed railway travel. So we became a country, I say we, people listening in Britain, or British people, if you're not listening in Britain, became road users primarily during the 1930s. The great innovation of railway during the 1920s has been gradually elbowed out of the way, not completely, but increasingly so. At the end of the 30s, Britain had the biggest car industry in Europe. Air travel, which was only for the very wealthy, expanded during the 30s. The British Empire became linked up through air power and through air travel. And air travel had distinctly colonial connotations. It was advertised as a way to see the empire, and the empire had a far greater value as a kind of the beginnings of mass tourism emerged during the 1930s, and the idea that people can go to places for the purposes of leisure. Even if they are extremely wealthy, you have to be extremely wealthy. There were networks between Britain, Africa, Asia and Australia that were operated by Imperial Airways. And there was obviously the beginnings of airmail throughout the empire as well. Imperialists had seen air power as a way of keeping the empire connected and under control, and believed that the bomber would eventually replace the gunboat. And if you go back maybe a dozen podcasts or so, there is a podcast I did on the British Empire in the 20s and 30s and the development of air policy that would eventually create the ideas behind mass bombing of Germany during the war. So during this transformation, this transport transformation, there's also the development of a media society. And mass media societies are really kind of integral to all our understandings of modernity. If you imagine a society that is linked temporally, so there are people who, as a synchronous society, if you will, somebody in London can know roughly the same things at the same times as somebody in Glasgow or Birmingham or Belfast. And this is key to creating a unified experience, so a unified sense of being in the same nation together. the development of mass communications seems to be central to the idea of modernity and the idea of kind of national identity in most developed and modern countries during the 20th century. Daniel Todman writes, "The interwar period saw a booming national press start to overtake the circulation of local newspapers and the rise of the cheap paperback in the emergence of the Left Book Club and the Penguin Special, a location for serious information and political discussion as well as popular entertainment. Still more striking was the advance of film and the onwards march of radio. By the late 1930s, the UK had about 5,000 cinemas now showing with sound and for the very first time, some films in colour as well as in black and white. Each week, a nation of 48 million inhabitants bought about 20 million cinema tickets. Newsreel programmes shown alongside or instead of main screenings presented audiences with a mixture of big events, exotic oddities, matters of local interest, all with a familiar and non-controversial commentary." So there's something really interesting there in the fact that local newspapers became eclipsed by national newspapers. Perhaps this was a generational change of older readers dying out and younger readers who are better educated and better informed, focusing on national issues and becoming politically active in national issues, quite possibly. But what it does indicate is that there was a transition away from more parochial thought or more parochial perspective during the 1930s towards a more national and perhaps even international perspective. In some ways, the experience of the First World War had possibly encouraged British newspaper readers to focus on bigger issues than those which occurred in their local area, and the trauma of a conflict which touched all aspects of national life in a way that no war previously had done. It can't be ruled out as a significant contributory factor. But also, the use of cinema newsreels, the famous Pathé newsreels, and radio also penetrated homes in ways that local newspapers had never done with knowledge and information of the outside world. Radio had been transformed during the 1920s from a kind of an eccentric hobbyist's project into a key aspect, not just of the information environment, but of the developing consumerism of Great Britain. So they became a key part of the of consumer lifestyles. By the 30s, there were a population of almost three quarters of British households had access to a wireless radio. And during the Second World War, this was one of the key ways that families found out and listened to what was happening around the world. British society was connected and networked on the eve of the Second World War in a way that it had not been on the eve of the First World War. British people were able to access information in ways that they had not been able to access. And that was something that the British government understood very well. The development of the Ministry of Information was key to winning the war on the home front, to ensuring the continuance of civilian morale, to make sure that misinformation and disinformation was not spread either by accident or on purpose, and to really harness and capture a mass audience of listeners before anybody else did. If you listen to the previous podcast I did about the Nazi Cultural Revolution during the 1930s, one thing that stands out there is that Hitler believed that unlike any other war, the First World War had been lost on the home front, and that morale now, civilian morale, and the will to carry on fighting and keep armies supplied with everything they needed was the most significant consideration for any war. I'm not sure that the British government believed to quite that extent, but they certainly knew that keeping the population informed in particular ways and directed in particular ways using state propaganda and information campaigns was absolutely vital. The mass media that emerged had managed to create very contemporary ideas of celebrity and fame that began to percolate during the 20s and the 30s, and began to, as previously said, kind of really ennoble the commentator, the educated expert who was able to explain new complicated scientific, social, political and philosophical ideas to an unknowing but eager to learn general public. The likes of J.B. Priestley, for example, the novelist and the playwright, who would speak with their audience via broadcasts, was a key example. Another key figure who became a popular voice of the left and also a popular figure in science was J.B.S. Haldane, of whom we've mentioned previously, and his ongoing feud with Lysenko, Trofim Lysenko, the fraudulent Russian agronomist and supposed scientist. The thing we'll move on to next is looking at the fragility of this society under the Great Depression and how gradually, bit by bit, America was slowly whittling away at Great Britain's economic supremacy and Britain as a kind of like a hegemonic world power. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and interesting, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with
Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.